ACIP, the voice of interventional pain management.
Thank you for joining us once again for the ACIP podcast. I'm Tom Prege with the American Society of Interventional Pain Physicians, and a special thank you to those who responded to our first podcast with suggestions. We'd like to hear from you too, with suggestions, comments, criticisms, or even compliments. Just email me, Tom, T-O-M, at ACIP, A-S-I-P-P, .org, Tom at ACIP.org. In this episode, we will once again be talking with Dr. Devi Nampiah-Parimpal. This time, we'll be discussing how you can use social media to help achieve your professional and practice goals. And in our news segment, we'll have stories about light waves being used as painkillers, $100,000 yearly prescription bills, sleepwalking and pain, and more. The ACIP podcast is sponsored in part by St. Jude Medical, makers of spinal cord stimulation and radio frequency therapy products. Visit them at professional.sjm.com. And by StimWave, maker of the Freedom Spinal Cord Stimulation System. Find out more about the Freedom Spinal Cord System at stimwave.com. Well, 2016 will be another busy year for ACIP didactic courses. At the end of February in Orlando, Florida, we will have three courses. The first one is a lumbar endoscopic disc decompression, advanced minimally invasive lumbar interventions review course and hands-on cadaver workshop. The second course is a controlled substance management course. And we will also have a third course, a regenerative medicine review course and hands-on cadaver workshop. We'll also have a competency exam in controlled substance management the day after that course. And in addition, the ABIP, or American Board of Interventional Pain Physicians Part 1 exam, will be held that weekend. For specific information on these courses and exams and to register for them online, just go to our website, ACIP, ASIPP.org. While on our website, why not go ahead and register for the ACIP 18th Annual Meeting in April? The Hyatt Regency Dallas will be the location. Details are starting to come together about the speakers and the topics, but we can tell you that the theme is Innovations in IPM, Incorporation for a Bright Future, Embrace the Developments. In future podcasts, we'll have details on speakers and topics, so be sure to check in with us every month. If you want to prepare for pain medicine board certification exams, well, ACIP Publishing has just what you need. ACIP's three-volume set titled Foundations, Clinical Aspects, and Board Review Self-Assessment were created to give clinicians a complete study course based upon the curriculum of the American Board of Medical Specialties Pain Medicine Examinations. Now, these books cover the specialty of pain medicine and interventional pain management, from their origins and history to the science and research behind the methods and techniques, to pharmacology, types of pain, complementary therapies, interventional and surgical techniques, and a whole lot more. Now, the self-assessment book is a comprehensive resource of 1,500 sample board exam questions, complete with thorough explanations of the answers. All three books are available in print versions as well as ebooks that you can load right onto your favorite e-reader. To order the set or individual volumes, just go to our website, ACIP, ASIPP.org. Now, as a sample of the content of these books, let's see if you can answer this question from Board Review Self-Assessment. Here's the question. Which of the following painful conditions is linked to a decrease in blood flow? Is it A, radiculopathy, B, myofascial pain, C, trigeminal neuralgia, D, migraine headaches, or E, complex regional pain syndrome? Think about that, and we'll have the answer in just a moment here on the ACIP podcast, and we will be talking to Dr. Devi Nampiah-Parimpal about social media. Stay with us. Welcome back to the ASIP podcast. Once again, here's the question from ASIP Publishing's Board Review Self-Assessment. Which of the following painful conditions is linked to a decrease in blood flow? Is it A, radiculopathy, B, myofascial pain, C, trigeminal neuralgia, D, migraine headaches, or E, complex regional pain syndrome? And the answer is B, myofascial pain. You knew that, didn't you, Dr. Devi?
Of course, thank you.
Dr. Devi Nampiah-Perumpul has joined us here on the ASIP podcast. She was on our inaugural podcast last month, and we talked about what I kept calling old school media, mass media. And today we're going to be talking about social media. But first, as a bit of an introduction, Dr. Devi is on the ASIP board, also serves on committees. You teach at, is it NYU?
Yes.
At NYU and at their medical school. Is that correct? The medical school?
Yeah. So I teach the medical students, residents, fellows, sometimes give faculty lectures. Yep.
Okay. And also a published author and something else new in your professional life.
Well, I just opened up a private practice in downtown Manhattan. It's called Metropolis Pain Medicine. So I'm kind of excited about the transition.
All right. Well, congratulations on that. Today, we are going to be talking about social media. So I guess we need to actually explain what we're talking about here, some definitions. First of all, what is social media and what are some of the better known social media sites?
Well, my definition, essentially, social media is another aspect of just regular media where you're trying to get your message out. But I guess the difference compared to other forms of media is that you have more options for interaction. So you can interact with your audience. Like, they can ask you questions. They can post or comment on what you're doing. So there's a little bit more of a one-on-one quality, even though it might be with people that you've never really encountered.
And what are some of the sites? The one that comes to mind first is Facebook, but that's not the only one.
Well, there's Facebook, there's Twitter. I mean, there are different ones like Instagram for photos or Pinterest. Some that are not strictly social media, but you could count them in that category are Yelp, sometimes DocDoc, because people have a chance to kind of comment on the type of care they're receiving. And then I guess you could group vitals.com and HealthGrades, but it's a little bit different because you're not interacting directly with people, and they don't really have they have some degree of anonymity there too, but in theory, you could respond to people's comments.
And those are the websites that I think of more for interaction with the public or patients. But there's also LinkedIn, which is more of a professional type of social media.
Sure. There's LinkedIn. There's Doximity also, which links a lot of folks, especially in medicine, you know, through medical school, through residency, and through fellowship. So there are some other sites like that that try to find some commonality between you and other colleagues and then link you together.
All right. So I've just brought up personal and professional. So social media can be used for either personal or professional purposes. Talk about keeping them separate. Is that important?
Well, that's kind of one of the things that I'm struggling with at times now, too, because, you know, initially the trap that some people fall into sometimes is that they try to do everything at once. So what will happen is, for example, let's say you have your personal profile on Facebook, then patients will start sending you friend requests, which has happened to me also. So you have to kind of have a plan about what you want to do. Do you want to keep it completely separate? Do you want to accept them as friends? Do you want to allow them to view some of your posts but not necessarily be able to see everything that you post? But then, you know, talking to people, especially in journalism and stuff, they told me just keep everything separate, your personal and professional lives. But that's also difficult because if you think about it, the people who might be most interested in your professional life are still people who are friends or colleagues, right? So they may or may not want to be following two different Facebook profiles or two different Twitter profiles. So it can get a little bit tricky. I would say you could do it either way, but you've got to have that plan and then kind of know how you're going to deal with these different situations that come up.
And I've also heard, and this is usually advice given to teenagers, that don't post anything that you don't want to be on there forever. And I guess that applies to adults, too, especially when using social media.
Sure. Sure. I think the biggest danger is actually with Twitter more so than Facebook and other sites, because Twitter, not only do you have to be careful about putting things out there, but you also have a limited character count. So I don't know how many people have used Twitter, but you only get to fit in a certain number of words in your posts. So you can also have, even if you're saying something that's, you know, totally okay, you're okay with other people seeing it, just because of the fact that you can't totally explain yourself, you know, it could be misconstrued. So you always have to be careful, I think, with Twitter posts, just checking to make sure your message is absolutely clear. And then even with Facebook, you know, there are things, I'm just going to talk about a couple of the pitfalls that I've seen. I've seen people share posts that they disagree with, but the assumption is that when you're sharing something, that you actually support it or that you're behind it. So, you know, you have to be careful about what exactly your, you know, Facebook profile or your social media accounts kind of relay. And then also, even when you're upset, I would actually take longer before posting, because sometimes people post things about, you know, just different things that happen to doctors or things that are annoying with insurance companies or you name it. But you have to think, if the public sees that, you might be talking to colleagues, but if it's publicly visible, then for other people who are looking at it, what kind of impression is it creating about you?
Yeah, there is no real privacy on the internet, is there? Or at least that's kind of my opinion.
I agree with you. And then even if you think something's private, I mean, even with email, people have sent me emails sometimes where it says, do not forward. Well, you know, okay, I don't. But in theory, if I wanted to actually keep a record of it, all I have to do is take a screenshot or a photograph. So I would say, generally, when you're doing anything online or even on paper, you know, be careful what you're saying. But I don't want to make people worry too much. You know, it's still an opportunity to engage patients, to engage people, to engage other professionals. But you just have to, you know, be careful about what you're saying.
Okay, we've talked about what not to put on a social media site, either Facebook or in a tweet from Twitter. What, enough of the negative, what about the positive? What kind of things do you suggest that a physician would put on a social media account?
Well, I think if they want to, it depends what their goal is, right? So if you want to engage patients, then social media could help you by giving you a chance to kind of post some information that might be relevant to patients or potential patients. So it gives you a chance to kind of get your message and your philosophy out there. Like, for example, I've seen other colleagues, you know, if they have their own, you know, ideas about opioid prescribing, and they want to make sure that patients understand that even before they come into the office. So if you're only prescribing opioids for certain reasons, or if you're not necessarily planning to take over prescriptions, that might be something that you could put out there on a website or somewhere else. I mean, you have to be careful, because just by mentioning opioids, you may attract a different audience. But it's something that can give patients information before they walk in the door. It's also something that you can use to follow up with patients afterwards, sort of like educational materials, and, you know, give people updates about developments in our field. I think that one of the things that social media might be able to help us with is in terms of saving time. But I've seen people sometimes end up spending a lot of time on social media because, you know, one of the issues that you'll run into is if you do have a social media profile, patients or whoever's following you will expect you to post on that, you know, relatively regularly. Or if they post a comment, they expect you to respond. So you might run into some issues if you don't necessarily have the time to respond to all those things. And I would also kind of define who your audience is, if it is patients or if it is professionals, because professionals reading something that's written for patients may not find it as useful. And patients reading something that's really geared towards people who practice in interventional pain, they may not find that useful. So it's important to kind of define who's supposed to be interacting with you.
There is so much free content on the internet that I think people are thinking that everything on the internet should be free. And how that ties in with this is, what do you do about somebody that asks for free medical advice through your social media site? How would you handle that?
Well, so I handle that like telephone calls sometimes. So if it's somebody that, you know, I don't know them at all, I'll put in a neutral statement maybe to support what they're saying if it makes sense. But I kind of make it clear this isn't medical advice. I mean, you might not be able to fit that in a tweet, but you can put that on your profile elsewhere on your website. And you could always say, you know, something very neutral, or give them something that they can follow up on, you know, in terms of talking to their doctor about something specific. Or if it's your patient, you know, bringing them into the office, like with a phone call, where you can only really discuss so much in a phone call or an email, but you can kind of get the ball rolling or plant some ideas, but they've really got to come in to have further evaluation. So I sort of treat it that way, but I would definitely not get involved in giving medical advice on a public website.
And that's for somebody who isn't a patient, I guess you have to keep in mind the HIPAA laws. If you had a current patient asking you something on a website, you wouldn't want to then start getting into their entire history.
Of course. And I actually have a consent form that I've sort of created for patients just about emails and about social media, because patients may assume, I mean, we're assuming that patients know more about these things than us, but they may assume that they have some privacy on the internet or on these websites. So if it's a patient that's in my clinic, then I try to let them know that beforehand. But sometimes you have folks who they're not your patients yet, but they want to know if you treat something, but then they give a little too much history, let's say, on your website or something else. So I actually changed the settings on my own website so that I have to approve all the comments before any of them become public, because the danger was before people would post things and it's just way too much information about their background. Even though they're posting it, I don't know if they really meant for people to be able to see all of that.
How often should a posting be made? Should you do it on a regular schedule or only when you have something to say?
Well, it should be ideally kind of a combination of both. So I think there has to be some type of predictable schedule for your followers. It doesn't mean you have to do something every day or multiple times a day. But I think it should be something, let's say if you're on Twitter or Facebook, where people kind of have some expectation that you might respond at a given time. But at the same time, if you don't have anything to say, then it's not worth just posting random stuff. You know, there should be something kind of something that would be valuable to your audience that you're actually posting about.
Who has time for all of this?
Well, that's a thing that I would say has to be kind of mapped out beforehand. I don't think that social media is necessarily something that everybody has to get involved in. It's only if it's going to be advantageous for you. So I think, you know, if you have a well-running practice, you already have everybody coming in, you have kind of a smooth system, you may or may not want to get involved in all the social media stuff, unless your patients are asking you for something and it might save you time. I think if you're building a practice, then social media is a tool because it can kind of get you out there, especially in internet search strategies and stuff. If you're on Facebook, if you're on Twitter, these are things that can pull you up in the search so that people might be able to find you. So I think it kind of depends what your goal is with the social media.
If somebody who's listening is not, doesn't have any social media accounts, either a Facebook or a Twitter account, how would you suggest they get started? What steps should they take to get started in this?
Well, I think Facebook is actually easier to manage than Twitter. Twitter has some constraints in terms of the character count and who would actually follow you. So I think that's a little bit more difficult, at least in terms of difficulty level. Facebook, for the most part, even if you don't have a Facebook account, you might know other people who do, and people are usually excited to kind of help you set up a profile. But even if you don't know that, you can usually just sort of set it up like Facebook will walk you through the steps. But again, I would just start out thinking about whether you're using it for a personal purpose or professional or some combination of both. And if it's a combination, then what are you going to do if patients start following you on your Facebook site, or especially even disgruntled patients, let's say, because these are the folks who tend to use social media also, right, to maybe say something negative about you. So I would just definitely have a plan about how you're going to deal with those things.
Good luck with your new practice up there in New York. And thank you so much for talking with us about social media, Dr. Debbie Nampia-Perimple, here on the ACIP podcast.
Thank you.
On this segment of the ACIP podcast, we take a look at some medical and pain news that you might have missed. The drug company Pfizer has released the results of a phase 3 clinical trial of Lyrica, known generically as pregabalin, that found the drug did no better than placebo in controlling chronic nerve pain from complex regional pain syndrome 2, also known as Causalgia. The results came from a nearly 4-month double-blind placebo-controlled trial. Pfizer's announcement was brief and to the point. Quote, the study did not meet its primary efficacy endpoint. According to Pfizer, Lyrica is indicated for the management of neuropathic pain associated with diabetic peripheral neuropathy, management of postherpetic neuralgia as adjunctive therapy for adult patients with partial onset seizures, management of fibromyalgia, and management of neuropathic pain associated with spinal cord injury. Despite the setback for treating causalgia, there are other studies in progress to determine if pregabalin is an effective treatment for muscle cramps, irritable bowel syndrome, scoliosis, phantom limb pain, and other conditions. Will light replace opioids as a painkiller? Well, that's the question being asked after researchers published their findings in the journal Neuron. Experiments were conducted in St. Louis at the Washington University School of Medicine. Rhodopsin, the protein in the eye's retina that responds to light, was used to modify mu opioid receptors. These artificially created receptors were then injected into mice brains. What researchers believe to be a dopamine reward response was stimulated by light. Additional research is needed, but light as a replacement for opioids is a possibility. The next research steps taken will likely explore the best way to activate and deactivate the opioid receptor pathways in the brain. In the experiments conducted by the researchers, responses varied based on the color of light shined at the mice, how long the exposures were, and whether the light was constant or pulsed. We all know that prescription drug costs can be all over the place based on what the drug treats, whether it is generic, and myriad other reasons. According to pharmacy benefit management company Express Scripts, there are 139,000 Americans whose prescription bill is $100,000 per year. That is nearly triple the number of patients from the year before. Additionally, nearly another 500,000 Americans had medication costs higher than $50,000 per year. New hepatitis C drugs are responsible for most of the huge spike in the number of patients who have such high prescription bills. These new Hep C drugs can cost up to $90,000 per patient. The findings were in a report released by Express Scripts titled "Superspending: Trends in High-Cost Medication Use." A related story in the New York Times reports that patient activist groups are advocating the voiding of patents that have already been granted, as well as not granting new patents for the Hep C drug Sovaldi. The Sovaldi course of treatment can cost $84,000. A New York-based group called the Initiative for Medicines, Access, and Knowledge, or IMAC, has filed challenges in Argentina, Brazil, Russia, China, and Ukraine. Sovaldi's creator, Gilead, is proposing that treatment in Brazil cost $7,500. But a Brazilian activist justified the fight against Gilead because she says that they have, quote, already recouped much, much more than was spent for Sovaldi's research and development. Generic versions are already being sold in India for $1,000. This is because in India, a patent was denied for Sovaldi's active ingredient, sofosbuvir. Fighting for its patents is nothing new for Gilead. They've weathered challenges to their drug patents that treat HIV. Sleepwalkers are known to be at an increased risk for headaches and migraines, but according to research published in the journal Sleep, the 4% of the population who suffer from sleepwalking, or somnambulism as it is known, are unlikely to feel pain while sleepwalking, even if they are severely injured while sleepwalking. The French study found that sleepwalkers have migraines 10 times more often than non-sleepwalkers. But most surprising was their finding that 47 of their 100 participants reported having a serious injury while sleepwalking, but only 10 of them immediately woke up because of the pain. In one case, the patient sustained severe fractures after jumping out a third-floor window, but did not feel the pain until later in the night. Another broke his leg after falling off the roof of his house, but didn't feel any pain until waking up the next morning. Patients on statin therapy for cholesterol might be at a high risk for contracting the flu, even if they have had a flu shot. The possibility is even greater in older patients. A retrospective study conducted by Dr. Stephen Black of the Center for Global Health at Cincinnati Children's Hospital looked at the medical records of 6,961 patients 65 years old and older. From 2009 to 2011, these patients had taken part in a flu vaccine clinical trial. 3 weeks after their vaccination, influenza antibodies were anywhere from 38% to 67% lower in those on statin therapy. In another story about statins, this one related to pain, a study published in the Annals of Neurology reported that simvastatin in combo with vitamin D3 can be effective as a prophylactic for episodic migraine in adults. The study was conducted at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Over 24 weeks, one group was given a 20 milligram tablet of simvastatin and a 1,000 IU vitamin D3 capsule twice a day. Another group was given matching placebo tablets and capsules. In the first group, at 12 weeks, a 50% reduction in headache days was seen in 25% of the patients. At 24 weeks, that number increased to 29%. The control group saw only a 3% reduction. And finally, add pharmacists to the list of professionals who are allowed to prescribe drugs with limitations in two states. California and Oregon will soon allow pharmacists to provide contraceptives to women without a doctor's prescription. Patients will first have to provide health information and their medical history. The birth control prescribed by the pharmacist will be covered by insurance. Public health advocates are hopeful that this will spread to other states, claiming that millions of women would have easier access to birth control. Let's take a look at some state society news. The Georgia Society of Interventional Pain Physicians has set their meeting date for 2016. The GSIPP 12th Annual Pain Summit will be held April 22nd through the 24th, 2016, at the Ritz-Carlton Lodge, Reynolds Plantation, in Greensboro, Georgia. Go to gsipp.com for details. The Florida Society of Interventional Pain Physicians will hold its annual meeting in 2016, May 20th through the 22nd. The meeting will be held at the Orlando World Center Marriott in Orlando. Watch fsipp.org for more details. The West Virginia Society of Interventional Pain Physicians will conduct a conference titled Pain 2016, presented by Dr. Timothy Deer, July 22nd through the 24th. The location for that? The Bahamas. The Atlantis Hotel on Paradise Island, to be specific. Details can be found at this website, and I will spell it out for you here. It is www.painconfreg.info. The ACIP podcast is sponsored in part by StimWave, maker of the Freedom Spinal Cord Stimulation System. Find out more about the Freedom Spinal Cord Stimulation System at stimwave.com. And by St. Jude Medical, makers of spinal cord stimulation and radiofrequency therapy products. Visit them at professional.sjm.com. Thank you once again to Dr. Devi Nampiah-Parimple for being our guest on this ACIP podcast. In our previous podcast, we reported on strange peer-reviewed research articles. Well, the BMJ, previously known as the British Medical Journal, has a tradition of publishing unusual peer-reviewed articles in their Christmas edition. Two of them have to do with doctors and their lifestyles. The first one looked at coffee drinking among physicians. By specialty, they found that the most coffee is consumed by orthopedic surgeons, followed by radiologists. In third place were general surgeons. The least amount of coffee was consumed by anesthesiologists. Another study looked at which medical school departments had the most leaders with mustaches. The top department with mustaches was psychiatry, followed by pathology, And in third place was anesthesiology. The fewest mustaches were seen in general surgery. That wraps up another ACIP podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, criticisms, or perhaps even compliments, just send me an email. That's Tom, T-O-M, at ACIP, ASIPP.org. Thank you for listening. This is Tom Prigge, and I hope you will join us next month for another ACIP podcast.